Hi, y'all. So I wrote this song to what I did, maybe some of y'all remember, but I took, I wrote this song when we finished this edition. And I took, I asked people to give me suggestions on how to write the song. I don't know that it really helped, but because I ended up writing what I wrote anyway. But Adam worked his magic, and you'll be able to sing the chorus with me if you want. It's called Let Make the Circle Bigger. It all started on a cold and snowy night, Neenah, Wisconsin, 1955. Nine brave souls met to make a place for liberal religion in a John Birch town. And they worked and they dreamed and they said, let's make the circle bigger. Let the flame grow brighter. More hands to hold. More hearts to love. More ways to make this world a better place. So we grew from living rooms to the Girl Scout hall to the Moose Lodge, where everybody had their own cup hanging on a hook, and Ari was down in the basement and the second floor was crumbling. That's right, baby. We worked and we dreamed and we said, let's make the circle bigger. Let the flame grow brighter. More hands to hold. More hearts to love. More ways to make this world a better place. Philip Lane Fellowship came to be in 1998, across from a field of trees, and a whole new wing for Ari. But soon we had to have four services and two ministers. And we worked and we dreamed and we said, watch out, don't go yet, 'cause times were tough and money was tight. We had to wait 8 more years to make our dream come true. But then we worked and we dreamed and we planned carefully and we said, let's make the circle bigger. Let the flame grow brighter. More hands to hold. More hearts to love. More ways to make this world a better place. Love you guys.
Good morning. My name is David Valguth. I'm one of the newer worship leaders here at the Fellowship. I've been a member here for a little over a year, and I've been coming to this welcoming place for over 2 years. And ever since coming here, Marie, the director of Congressional Life, I think you know, has encouraged me to become more involved, and well, here I am. I also appreciate Reverend Christina and Reverend Leah for giving me this opportunity. A few weeks ago, us worship leaders got together as a group to go over things, including signing up for weeks that we would be interested in helping out with the service. This week was particularly interesting to me because it's about history, UU history, and this fellowship's history. Since I've been coming here, I've had the chance to learn about other members' history and where they came from and how they wound up here. I've learned what it's like to live as a pagan. I've learned about Jewish customs and traditional foods, travels abroad that I'll never be able to go on, and various other subjects. And I find these stories very interesting. I thought this would be a good time to share a bit of my history, where I came from, and how I ended up here. I grew up in a very Lutheran household, a very conservative Wisconsin Synod household, and it was back in the 1850s that my great-grandfather, Frederick Valguth, designed Trinity Lutheran Church in Milwaukee. As you can see in these pictures, great-grandfather was a talented architect when he created this structure in Victorian Gothic design. Here are some of my cousin's grandkids standing next to the stone that still bears his name. You may have heard about Trinity recently as it suffered a major fire in May, where over 100 firefighters were called to put out the blaze. While I no longer belong to a Lutheran church, I will always be proud of the mark my ancestor left with this historic structure. They did just decide to rebuild because it's still stable enough to use. Great-grandfather also designed Zion Lutheran Church, which is here in Appleton on Oneida Street. My grandfather was a principal at a Lutheran school in the Milwaukee area, and then I had an uncle who was a prominent pastor in West Allis. And instead of sending me to the public schools that my older siblings went to here in Appleton, my parents put me in Mount Olive Lutheran School here in Appleton. My parents wanted a pastor in the family. This is as close as they're going to get. It was early in eighth grade when my parents finally let me transfer out of Mount Olive to Einstein Junior High, where I could participate in more competitive sports and be where most of my friends are that were outside of school. It was only a week after eighth grade ended that I had a diving accident. My uncle, the pastor, and our pastor from church came to the house to counsel and console my parents, and told him that my injury was penance for letting me leave Mount Olive. That was the last time I ever saw a pastor at church, and I didn't see my cousins or my uncle for 4 years. We moved our membership to a less conservative synod church named Faith Lutheran here in Appleton. We were never quite the same parishioners we once were after my accident. Then years later, Faith announced that it was ending a 60-year sponsorship of a Boy Scout troop when the troops announced they were going to start allowing LGBT people to be troop leaders. And that was enough exclusionary behavior for me. I called many other Lutheran churches in town and asked them if they agreed with what Faith did. And I was surprised to learn that they all did. Living close to the fellowship, I decided to call and see what their feelings were on the subject. And of course, they do not agree with Faith's actions. So here I am, and I'm glad that I found this welcoming place. I look forward to hearing more about other members and their history, as well as UU history. Thank you for having me.
My name is Marty Wheeler. And after Ty's son, I'm not sure I need to say anything. But anyway, when my family joined the fellowship back in 1985, there was a Sunday morning service with an organized RE program, and the fellowship was a member congregation of the Unitarian Universalist Association. But that wasn't always the case. In going through the archives, we found documents on the process that the early members used to discern who they should affiliate with. They researched and discussed Unitarians, Quakers, Universalists, the Ethical Society. They also looked at Humanists and Baha'is. But then on April 21st, 1957, the membership voted to become part of the American Unitarian Association. During this time, they also worked to establish a church school. Again, they had speakers and they looked at various curriculums and took over a year to organize the church school. Bill Dunwoody, one of the founders, said in a CD that we found about the history of the fellowship that the RE program was one of the most important decisions they made. A couple of other interesting things I learned. In one newsletter, it was reported that the executive team had met and, to quote, discussed the budget, which, whether realized or not, had been in existence since they organized. The budget at that time was $500 per year, and they suggested that each family give $30. Budgets and contributions could be sent to the treasurer, Bert Browning. Please make the checks out to Bert, but you might want to put in the memo line that it was for the fellowship. And thus started the journey of creating this community that each of us has found in our own way. The fellowship grew and had about 30 families in 1957. And if you notice the bricks out front, the first row are the founders, and there are 15 founder family bricks out there. So in 2 years, they had 30 families. And the things continued to go along, but then growth sort of stalled. And by 1974, there might be only 10 people at a service. And the RE program was stopped, and the children were sent to the UCC church. So what to do? And they decided that they really wanted to continue to be in existence and to grow. So they took some very deliberate steps to becoming more welcoming and to open and be well open for new members. They put some structure into the service, such as having a set ending time. They invited more guest ministers to come, and they did some public relations, and they grew. And they were able to purchase a building on Superior Street. And then they made the decision to become part of the UUA's Extension Minister Program. We found plans in the archives to redesign the main floor, the adult space, if you will, of the Superior Street building. That did not happen, but the RE spaces were redone. From a dark, dingy bar, it became three brightly lit classrooms, a gathering space, and a nursery with bright characters painted on the walls. As growth continued, we were able to call our first settled minister, a very young, right out of seminary, Reverend Roger Birchhausen. Planning continued, and we remained welcoming. In our 1989 mission statement, it stated, "We embrace diversity and strive to accept and welcome people of all ages and perspectives with respect and openness." It became clear that we needed to do some major work on the Superior Street building if we wanted to be accessible to everyone and also to be large enough to welcome everyone. So we started planning. We did our usual slow planning, exploring many options and figuring out how we could remain welcoming and grow to the point where we could afford a new building. We went to two services, and then a group of fellowship members loaned us the money so we could purchase the land that we are currently sitting on. It was a 5-year loan, And during that 5 years, we paid back that loan. We paid off the mortgage on the Superior Street building. We increased staff hours. By then, we had a part-time DRE, part-time administrator, plus Roger. We designed our current building. We held a capital campaign to make it happen. So we did a lot in that 5 years. During that time, we also decided to start taking up a formal offering and passing the collection plate. It took about a year and a lot of discussion to make that happen. And a few people were unhappy, but we did it. And that's also at the time that we started taking up at least one collection a month that we gave to the wider community. In 1995, we wrote the case statement for building this building, and it stated, "We were welcomed here, but have no room to welcome others. Backed by the strength of our congregation, supported by our minister, we are determined to build a new home, inviting and accessible to all who seek us. Now it is our turn to carry on the vision, to extend the warmth we feel here to others, and to spread the spirit and share our vitality. And I feel that this is a spirit that continues with us today." As the fellowship grew, we did change how we governed ourselves. If you were a board member in the 80s, you would have been prepared for very long board meetings. Besides the four officers, all committee chairs, the DRE, and the minister were part of the board. Every detail of the life of the fellowship was discussed and discussed and discussed at board meetings. And then many of the thoughts and ideas were taken to the membership to be discussed some more and often to be voted on. Annual budgets were set during the annual meeting. A proposal was brought in. Folks would write on a card what they could pledge or give that year. Finance committee went into the kitchen, added up the numbers, made sure the budget balanced then, brought it back, and the membership voted on it. In the late 80s, we did start the every member canvas so that we could go into an annual meeting with a budget that was balanced, and it also helped us grow the budget so that we could afford to call a settled minister. Board structure changed to being just the four officers and then members at large, with all of the committee chairs meeting separately in the Council of Chairs. And we tweaked that model and moved toward our current policy governance that gives the X team oversight of the day-to-day operations here at the fellowship, which means things can actually get done in a timely manner. They don't have to wait until the monthly board meeting for a discussion. And then the governing board has a responsibility to monitor that the fellowship is moving forward on the mission statement that we've all agreed to, and to look at the long-range plans of who we wish to become. The board and the executive team offer many opportunities for us members and friends to offer our hopes and dreams for the fellowship. Last week after service, I had to talk to Reverend Christina because she said one of her biggest surprises here was that while we had grown so fast, a lot of our policies hadn't kept up and that they needed to be worked on. And I said, one of our strengths was we changed governing structure. And she assured me that that was one thing we have done well, that we have a good, strong governance model here. So I believe that a lot of why our board works so well is because we change our lay leadership very often. It's not one group of people that have leadership responsibility here. It changes, and I've seen, you know, like five generations of leaders come through the years. So they keep bringing in their new ideas and a lot of new energy. So have we always done well? No. We have made mistakes along the way. Members have disagreed on the best path forward. Holes in procedures have been found. But we did walk But we didn't walk away from those times. Situations were looked at, a better path forward was found. Institutional changes were made to help the community do the best possible. The Healthy Congregation team helps us deal with situations where there may be disagreement between committees, members, and such. The Audit Committee is strong and independent and looks at financial records and policies and procedures in detail on a quarterly basis. We are working on looking at how white supremacy plays in the culture of this fellowship and what changes we need to make. Come from founders with a vision and the energy to start this journey, which we have all been welcomed to join. We come from many years of friends and members continuing to have a vision for the fellowship and the energy to make it happen. We have a plan of where we are going, and it's going to be fun to be a part of that and see what unfolds.
My name is Terry Dawson. I was enjoyed the opportunity to spend time in the fellowship archives with the other folks. It was really a reminder of the way things were, of the individual stories that we all bring and the collective story that we make together. When our family joined the fellowship, there was just the one staff person, our minister, and one service. I was really attracted by the casual atmosphere back in 1991. In addition to the joys and concerns and congregational response, we didn't have a collection plate. We used to take the summers off. Whoever helped with building maintenance or cleaning could always grab a beer out of the fridge. And as Ty noted in his song, there's a rack in the back of the hall where we could each keep our own coffee cup. Just about everybody seemed to have their own key to the building. And once a month we had soup after the service. A year or two later, we had expanded to two services, which I felt was perfect. I could teach RE during one service and was still able to get to know just about everyone, all the members and regular friends. But at that point, I did not realize how quickly it was already changing. Our family was part of a boom in the membership. Some might say that that boom was driven by having our first full-time minister, Roger, who had only arrived 6 months before our family joined. There's no doubt that he was a big factor, but it was not merely Roger's leadership, preaching, and community spirit that drove our growth. Those qualities were on some level an articulation and expression of those qualities and values here in our congregation in the way that we were serving a growing need in the Fox Cities. We were living a mission of welcoming personal growth and justice, and people who needed us found us, just as our family had, and so we grew, and we needed a bigger and more accessible building. As Marty talked about, we went through a deliberate, inclusive, and occasionally painful process to go from that casual group that met in the old Moose Lodge to this building. In the process, there were gains and losses. We gained a lot of new people and new capabilities, while we lost the ability for anyone to easily know everyone. But we kept making the circle bigger, doing more to fulfill our mission with more people in the community. We became mindful about relating to one another as a healthy congregation. So in 2002, just 4 years after we moved in here, the archives had memos about starting a new building committee to create an expansion, with construction to start as early as 2005. This might seem like it was happening quickly, but in fact it had always been a part of the plan for this building that at some point we would build a real sanctuary and other spaces as needed. Now, in fact, with increased staff, more services, the need for feasibility studies, the building committee was not formed for a few more years, but by the spring of 2006, we were rolling. We had hopes for a 2007 capital campaign and starting construction as early as 2008. As usual with our big decisions, there was widespread congregational involvement as we held many dream phase meetings at homes and here in the fellowship. Lots of us, often passionately, shared our visions and ideas of what functions and spaces were needed to further our mission. At least one dream space gathering recorded that their top choice for a building addition would be a climbing wall. There may have been a guy named Dr. Bill in that meeting, I'm not sure. the May 2006 congregational meeting, we voted to start design work. At a special meeting that October, the congregation looked at four design concepts and approved a two-story building with program and education spaces in a full basement under the sanctuary. Even without the climbing wall, we were very excited. However, struggles with stewardship and a later feasibility study by the UUA confirmed that we were not ready to support the ambitious $2.6 million building project. We decided to wait a little, and then came the market and housing crash of 2008, and we knew that we were going to have to plan much more affordably. So we scaled back, then decided to divide the project into two phases and only do the first part. Things left for phase two included a meditation room, which was another high priority in the dream phase, a finished balcony with an elevator, and more education and program rooms. That left us with a budget that was half that of our first plan, and even this got scaled back. But in December 2009, we approved a capital campaign for the fall of 2010. The campaign succeeded wildly thanks to widespread involvement by many, and design proceeded through 2011, again with congregational input and feedback. Money remained tight, and we continued to have to trim project elements, including even the unfinished balcony here in the sanctuary, and the covering for the patio outside, landscaping elements such as waterfalls. It's worth asking, by show of hands, how many people even knew that we were going to have a balcony in here? Okay, a lot of you. Good. The floor of this room was constructed with footings to support a balcony. And the curved wall over there, we've got this giant chalice over on this side of the room. This curve of the chalice conceals the ramp up to the chancel here. The other curve of the chalice is where the stairway will be located to go up to the balcony for the inside access with an elevator and another stairway outside. If we ever decide to do it, the balcony would support about 150 people. But it got left out. Only a fairly late donation in the process allowed us to add and finish the legacy room across the hall. But we had the first service in this space on Christmas Eve of 2013. So here we are in 2018. Last week, as Marty said, Reverend Christina noted that our very rapid growth meant our infrastructure has lagged behind our membership. And reviewing our history, we can see where this has sometimes left us with some conflicts. The 1997 conflicts over this building, the unrealistic expectations in 2007 for our expansion. But I feel like we've engaged this mindfully with ongoing efforts of the Healthy Congregation team, work of the membership engagement team, very importantly, more responsible staffing levels and compensation for our staff, and the hiring of a new senior minister who sees our past, present, and future with fresh eyes and is challenging us to be more mindful about how we are inclusive. I'm further encouraged by recent planning and stewardship and organizing our social justice work. We have a great and fascinating history, but I believe our best days are yet to come, and that there will be more ways to embrace more people. May it be so.